Hey, welcome to Project Recovery, a podcast about addiction. More importantly, it's about recovery. And unfortunately, today is a somber day for the Project Recovery family. Although we say this podcast is a podcast that celebrates recovery, we sometimes, or at least myself, I get a little naive about the possibilities of recovery.
Well, we are fortunate because, and I think we've both said, and maybe it is a little selfish, like we love doing the show because we get a boost from our guests who have overcome their addiction. They're living in recovery and they're doing amazing things here in our community. And that's the focus of this show. But the reality is there are more people losing the battle to addiction than are winning it. And it's not something we highlight on the show very much, but I think you and I spoke a few days ago, like for this reason that you're going to introduce, we probably need to highlight the fact that people don't always make it into and stay in recovery.
Unfortunately, in the past week, we lost a friend, a former guest here on the podcast, Seneca Higley.
Yeah, he was a great guest and a friend of the show.
He passed away. People are still waiting for the toxicology and everything. So I really don't know exactly what happened. But all signs would indicate that he lost his battle to addiction.
That he had a relapse and, mm-hmm. and that took his life.
Yeah. And it really hit me hard. I got a call from our community letting me know that he had passed away. And as I sat on the couch and tried to compute, digest, interpret all of that, I went through a range of emotions that I hadn't felt in a long, long time. I cried. I screamed. I sat in just complete silence because it just puts an exclamation point on the fact that this disease is a deadly disease that's killing too many people. And I don't know. It's one of those things because I want to help. And I think this podcast is helping. But there is nothing you can do. I can't make you stop. I can't, you know what I mean? I can be there, I can support, and I can do the things that I know how to do. But ultimately, it comes down to the addict. And that's what's so sad about this, is that, you know, it's a family disease, and it affects so many from just that one person. But that one person has to... It falls solely on them. Does that make sense? I mean, so I mean, I'm confused in my speaking right now because it's just so emotional and so raw. It's like, is there something I could have done? And I know the answer. There's not. And I try to do everything I can, but
I think you and I are feeling a little bit of what, you know, to some degree, a small amount of what we've had parents talk about on the show before, family members. We've had aunts and uncles. We've had people on the show that talk about their loved one's addiction and say kind of the same thing. Like, I feel like I've done everything I can do. What else can I do? They feel powerless because in the end, all the resources can be available. The support can be available. Tough love, supportive love, all sorts of things. In the end, if that addict isn't in a place where they're ready to take the leap into sobriety and recovery, then, I mean, that's the final piece, right? And maybe the most important piece. And then we've had people on the show before that we know have relapsed. And, you know, but I think this hits especially hard because Seneca has ultimately lost his battle with addiction. And it's hard knowing that we had him here in the office, that we're friends with him, that he's actually part of the Project Recovery community. I don't know if people who listen to the show realize, but a lot of these folks that come on the show know each other outside of our show.
It's a wonderful community.
It hits everybody really hard.
Seneca was at my 50th birthday party.
Yep, he was there.
Seneca was there when we debuted the television show of me and my kids going to Mexico. He had brought mm-hmm. his daughter over to my house, sat on the couch with my mother and my brother and my girlfriend and my kids. And he was a part of my family and a part of my group. And I had just talked to him 2 weeks prior because we had done some auctioneering together.
If people remember the episode, he's the auctioneer.
Yeah, and he's an amazing auctioneer. And I do auctioneering, but he's way better than I am.
He was a master.
He's legit. And so we would do it together where I would stand up and I would talk about the item. I would engage the audience, and then I would turn it over to him, and he would do what he did so well with his voice, and we'd raise money for great causes. I mean, it takes me back to this thing. We were doing this thing for the Weber School Foundation up in Ogden, and it was their Christmas Jubilee. And we're standing in front of a group of probably 500 to 1,000 people. And these are big wigs in the Ogden community, titans of industry. And you've got two addicts in recovery up on stage, you know, trying to raise money for schools and for homeless outreach and stuff like that. And my first joke was, you know, normally if you see these two faces together, you're looking at mugshots. But we're not. We're right. Two guys who are trying to get our lives back together and want to give back to a community that's given us so much.
And that's the power of recovery. You start doing things like that.
And it was amazing. And after our performance, we did such a good job, they immediately invited us back for next year. And then there's a couple other foundations that were in the room that said, we do an auction that's similar to this. Would you guys be willing to do this? And so I talked to Seneca, and I was like, we can do this, buddy. Me and you can go out there, and we can give back, and we can have some fun, and this will be cool. And he was excited. And we had three other ones on the book. And so, I mean, it just really hit me hard because I didn't know if he was slipping. I've heard rumors that, you know, that there was some slipping. And I feel bad that he never reached out. I feel bad that I didn't know. I don't know what I could have done, but I would have at least lent my ear.
What do you think? I mean, I don't really know the answer to what my question is. And that is, what do you think we should do? What do you think friends and family should do when you hear rumors that somebody has, you know, had a backslide in their sobriety?
Because
it's a hard one, right?
Yeah, it really is, because...
Because it's a rumor.
Yeah.
You don't know for sure.
And relapses happen.
And relapses happen, and I think the smart person recognizes that relapses are part of the process. Not that you seek them out, but you can't see them as a definitive fail unless... In this case, it's the last relapse. But relapses do happen. How many people do you and I know who have had many relapses but are now solidly in recovery? Like, not that you take it for granted or think you've got it licked, because you can't do that, but relapses can be part of the process. So what do we do?
And that's the thing, is I don't have the answer. And it comes back to the addict having to be an honest, and the disease that makes you lie and manipulate. You don't want to look at someone's face and tell them that you relapse, because although they might understand relapse happens, you can see the disappointment on someone's face.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And as an addict, you'll do anything and everything not to see that disappointment. And that's what leads you to the deception and the lying, because I'm going to try to get out of this because I don't want to see the hurt on your face, because you can't hide the hurt. You can't hide it. I wouldn't have face-to-face conversations with loved ones if I'd been drinking, because I didn't want to see that look on their face. Yeah. And that's what led me to isolation. And so I wouldn't have to see that. And so when I was drinking, I would call people because they couldn't see my face. They couldn't see my face. And so
that makes sense. Yeah.
I don't know what we could have done.
So here's an interesting question. Do you think being public with your recovery, a person's recovery, you or whomever, Seneca, or being part of this big community that so many people are part of, I think it's positive. We always talk about it in a positive way. Can it also be a pressure that the person, you know, feels if they, you know,
they don't want to let the group down again?
Exactly.
But
does that make you more secretive if you're having a relapse?
I think it can. But I think if you really understand the community that you're a part of, that's the greatest thing about the recovery community. There is no judgment.
I agree. I think they're the least judgmental people I've ever met.
We've had people on here who've said some of the most shameful things that they've done in their addiction.
Yeah.
And put it out there, where I've sat in this chair and heard somebody say something. I was like, whoa, I can't believe you're putting that out there. But they go, but that was me. And if I don't address it and I don't talk about it, then the secrets keep us sick.
We recently reran Brandon Novak's episode. Mm-hmm. And if any of you follow him on social like we do, you know that he continues to talk about, in a very matter-of-fact way, some of the extremely shameful behaviors that he engaged in order to keep his habit going. And sometimes I'll see that on Facebook or Instagram and be kind of surprised, like, oh, does he need to keep saying that? But I think he does, for him, and also to remind people of how serious this disease is.
I maybe it is a joke, but I spend a lot of time on Facebook and Instagram, and I will see memes that come out with like Bradley Cooper or mm-hmm. Who's Iron Man?
Robert Downey Jr.
You know, and talk about their sobriety and talk about things that they've done or show their picture of their mugshot. And yeah. I think to myself, I was like, you know,
that this picture of Robert Downey Jr. in handcuffed orange jumpsuit.
Yeah. Yeah. And I go, I mean, he's been sober for 20 plus years. I mean, how long is he going to wear that? And then I think, well, maybe this is what keeps him sober, is that it reminds him of where his life can go, even if he thinks he's capable of having one
drink. It's got to be part of the formula, right? Like owning that and not beating yourself over the head with it, because somebody like him or you and other people in recovery, you want to accept that you are this person now, mm-hmm. but that you could slip back into that person. So I think it plays a role. It's sort of maybe like an anchor to kind of keep you anchored in your reality.
You know, and one of the reasons that I do this podcast is it keeps me grounded, and it keeps me, I mean, I wear my sobriety like a badge of honor, and I will work it into any conversation that I can, just for the fact that I want to take ownership in it. I don't want anyone to have backdoor conversations about who I was or who I am.
And I think you like to burst that bubble, yeah, just to get it out of the way, right?
Yeah.
Like, you've talked to me about that.
And so I work it in. Like, if I can work it into a conversation, I don't force it on anybody, but if I can work it in, I work it in, because it makes me feel more comfortable in any conversation, especially meeting new people, because mm-hmm. of who I am and what happened to me. I know there's a lot of people that are wondering.
Get rid of that elephant in the room.
Yeah. You know, so let's just address it and let's just move on.
And for public figures, and to a large degree, Seneca was a public figure as well, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, with his auctioneering and being on this show, and he's been a big promoter of sobriety and recovery in lots of settings. I think it's... I think that's the way to go, is to embrace ownership of that, because people already know about it. And I think it's good for you.
And Seneca was an amazing man, and I don't want anyone to think that I'd never thought he was. And I love that guy with all of my heart, and I was impressed with what he overcame. If you go back and listen to his episode, he lived in California in the gutter for 2 years.
On Skid Row.
Skid Row. He'd been stabbed multiple times.
Which is a real place, not just a band. A lot of people don't know that there's a real place.
I remember when he was sitting in here and he was talking about a story of how he met some guys, and they were going to go to a hotel room and they were going to get high, and they ended up jumping him and stealing his backpack and taking everything he owned, including his teeth. And he walked around for over a year without teeth.
Yeah.
And he was so humble and so generous and so genuine, it just made you love him. And so I don't know exactly what happened. I can tell you this, that this disease is ugly. And if this wasn't a KSL podcast, I would be cursing like a sailor, talking about how much I hate this disease, because I hate this disease. And what's crazy about it is it's a disease that is manageable. It's a disease that you can...
I mean, it's treatable.
Treatable.
People are in recovery. They are doing amazing things. They're living their best life.
But that doesn't negate how brutal this disease can be.
Well,
just to show you, Seneca has a beautiful young daughter. She's been to my house. She was vivacious. She was fun. She was curious. This poor young girl had lost her mother 7 months earlier to the disease. So now this poor girl has lost her mother and her father within a year to the disease.
Yeah.
And that's where my heart breaks. My heart breaks for his family. My heart breaks for him. My heart breaks for her mother. And it's just, and you want to go, why? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. You know what I mean? And that's the thing. And I saw this thing that says, you know, we say it on the podcast all the time, addiction doesn't discriminate.
Right.
You know what else doesn't discriminate? Recovery.
That's true.
Recovery doesn't discriminate.
Yeah.
And sometimes I feel guilty. And that was another one. And I don't know if it's me being selfish or what, but I sit there. So here's the deal, man. I'm learning this daddy-daughter dance with my daughter because it was their drill night. And we're sitting there in my foyer, and she's teaching me to dance, and we're doing choreographed dancing. And I'm having the time of my life because I'm laughing with my daughter. And I'm thinking to myself, how lucky am I, man, that I get to do this? Because at one point, I didn't think it was going to be possible, and we're having a great time. And then the phone rings, and I find out that we lose Seneca to this disease. And I'm thinking, this is not fair. Why do I get to have this life? Why do I get to have these moments with my daughter? And then this poor girl has lost both her parents to the disease. And people will say, well, you don't understand his plan, or you don't, you know.
I agree.
I don't see anything good coming from this. You know, luckily this lovely young lady has a grandparents that love her, and she's surrounded by people who love her, who yeah. go above and beyond and do whatever we can to give her some sort of normalcy. But I don't know what that looks like.
Well, you know, what do you say? I mean, she's lost both of her parents to the disease of addiction. That's going to be her burden to bear throughout her life, to figure out how to manage life that way. I can only hope that her family and friends do continue to rally and support her. But that is a very profound example of how serious this disease is and how detrimental it is to human beings. And the reality is there is no fair. It is absolutely not fair. You know, we work hard to get the things that we want to get in life and hope that it takes us in a healthy direction. We do know that it's much more likely to have the experiences that you had dancing with your daughter in your living room if we're clean and sober.
If I'm not clean and sober, I don't get that opportunity.
Yeah. And you know, but I think I barely knew Seneca. You knew Seneca well. I think I can say, of course, he would have loved to have those experiences too.
I can tell you without a doubt.
It's not like you make a choice
to do that other thing.
And that's what I think a lot of listeners need to really hear is.
Did he love his daughter? 100% with everything he had and would do anything. And people go, anything? Including stop? That's not how this disease works.
You wouldn't say that to a parent who died of cancer, right?
Yeah.
Right? Like, I mean.
But that's the thing.
It's a disease.
And so part of me, like, I'll read obituaries or I'll read stories of people who have passed and from overdose, and in their obituary, it will just tell you all the great things. And I understand telling all the great things.
Yeah.
And celebrating their life.
And that's the time to do it, I guess.
But also,
we should have a little reality check sometimes.
100%. Because, like, I want to talk about Seneca, and I want to talk about the amazing man he was, and I want to talk about the wonderful things he did and the things he overcame and all that. But we've also got to talk about the things that happened to him, and so that we can have a conversation about the disease, about addiction, and how we can help, and what can we do. And
I want to preempt some Facebook comments that I know are going to be coming because of me emphasizing the disease here. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that every biological process we have is also influenced by, and sometimes even caused by, behavioral things in our life. So I used cancer a moment ago, and I said, you know, and hopefully this would never happen, that somebody would say, you know, blame the parent for leaving the child because they passed away from cancer. Mm-hmm. But the truth is, a lot of the behavioral choices and the environments we live in influence the cancers that we developed. Not 100%, but there's genetic factors. There are also behavioral and environmental factors. Mm-hmm. Your personality is both biological and environmental. And things like substance abuse and addiction do have a behavioral component, but they're also biological. And so it is really naive to continue to promote this this concept that you could just stop using your addiction, that it's a choice, that it's a behavior where we're blaming the victim or the addict. And so I need people, if you doubt what I'm saying, please do some research. In fact, at the end of our episode today, I'm going to provide everybody with some a place to go for resources to help with preventing overdose. But in that same website, that there's great research to educate yourself. Don't hold on to outdated concepts. Don't hold on to prejudiced ideas. Educate yourself about addiction and realize it is a disease. And someone like Seneca absolutely loved his daughter. And I'm sure her mother did as well.
Loved his
and
friends, now, loved his family.
He, you know, this disease
It would
disease
be the first
has,
one there if you asked him if you needed anything. Sure. It would be the first one there.
Well, he was your cheerleader too.
And I loved him with all of my heart. And, you know, when you're talking about choice, because people say it all the time on the Facebook, and I don't even engage him anymore because I'm just not going to do that.
Right.
The choice I have in my sobriety and in my disease, the one choice I have every day is do I pick up a beer or do I not? Because if I pick it up, that is a choice, and I drink it. After that, I don't have a choice. My mind, my body takes over, and my brain, and it hijacks everything. It right. makes me do things that I would never do. It makes me say things that I would never say. And so I don't do it. I'll admit there. I have a choice to pick up. But sometimes yeah. the urges and the things you're going through, like I don't know everything that Seneca was going through. I don't know what his life looked like. Yeah. I don't know what it was. I wish he would have reached out. I wish he would have asked and would have told me and needed somebody to talk to. I would have done that. But it didn't happen. But that's the only choice I have.
Yeah. And, you know, if there's one thing I've learned in 20 plus years of being a psychologist, even with education and experience working with people and how brains work and all of that sort of thing, I do know for sure I never really know what it's like to be somebody else.
Right.
You never really know. You never know all the pressures and things that might go into what we look at as a behavioral choice, but it's a lot more complicated than that. My heart breaks for Seneca's daughter and for the whole community, the people that loved him, his other family members and friends. And all we can do, I think, is if you have an inkling that somebody needs your support, whether it's a mental health issue or an addiction issue or both, I always think it's great to reach out and let them know you're there. Because we don't know what they're going through, they may not cop to it or accept your help, but it doesn't mean it wasn't useful.
I get Facebook messages or people texting me asking, wondering about people and how they're doing in their sobriety and would I check in on them. And the one thing that I do and I try to do and I could probably do better at it is just simply reach out and go, hey, just was thinking about you.
Yeah.
And if you ever need to talk, if anything's going on, please let me know. Because I think sometimes in the addict world, and I can just talk from my experience alone, is if you accuse me, I get defensive. You know, I mean, out of the gate.
Yeah, well, most people, I think.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah, and like, well, what did you hear? What's going on? And, you know, and so that's why when people have these rumors, how do you go, hey, look, I just want you to know that there's a rumor floating around.
I think it depends a little bit on your relationship. Doing something's better than doing nothing, I guess.
If I would have heard the rumor, I would have reached out.
Well, I don't think you need to hold on to that or anything. You spent a lot of time with Seneca and you know, he wasn't able or willing or whatever to let you know he was struggling. And we're making a few assumptions here. I think it's important for everybody to know all signs point to a relapse, but we don't have all the data at this point. I think we're probably correct in that. And that this is secondary to a relapse. But, even when we do reach out, when we tell somebody we're thinking of them, or if we're more specific and say, hey, I've heard this rumor, you know, I know I think I would appreciate that and you would appreciate that. But people are, you know, that's the hard thing. And as a psychologist, sometimes I wish I had done some other kind of medicine where it's like I could just, you know, do surgery on your ankle and now it works again. You didn't really have to participate. You just had to hold still.
Yeah.
The problem with mental health interventions of all types is it's collaborative. Like you have to work with the person. So even if an addict is in a position of having all the right services, support and help, they have to participate and they're not always ready. And that's okay. Our job is to be patient and to be supportive until they're ready. But the sad truth is, if you look at the numbers, I actually, since this happened, spent a fair amount of time looking at the research. And, you know, different reports say different things. What we do know is a lot more than half of people don't make it into their full recovery. Mm-hmm. And relapses, you know, make the data hard to manage, but it isn't that 90% of people are getting better. It's not something like that.
No.
We have a lot of work to do and a long way to go. And, you know, you and everybody else provided Seneca with a lot of love, care, support, friendship. But that's the power of the disease. And the little I knew him, I doubt he didn't appreciate that like crazy. I know he did.
So knowing Seneca like I knew Seneca, and he would want us to be talking about this. He would not want us to shy away from this. He would like his death to mean something and, you know, be a warning for those out there, and let them know that addiction is real, that we should be talking about it. Do not shy away from it. I mean, I think that's why he wanted to come on the podcast in the beginning, was to tell his story.
Sure.
And so he's an advocate of recovery, and I think he would want us to be talking about this. And
I think one thing that I'd like to share before we wrap it up today is, you know, so we've really, in a frustratingly way, we've asked, what can we do?
Like, yeah.
What can a listener do? What can a person do? Even somebody who, you know, is close, we don't always know what's going on. But there are resources. And so a government health agency called the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, often just referred to as SAMHSA. So it's SAMHSA.gov, is a great resource for information. But specifically, if you go onto their website and type in the search bar, Overdose Prevention and Response Toolkit,
mm-hmm.
that is a free PDF that you can download and in just a matter of minutes, really educate yourself on everything you need to know to be an advocate and help prevent overdoses and help respond if an overdose has happened to somebody in your area.
And I think it's important to have that information readily available for everybody, not just those who have loved ones battling addiction.
But the thing is, you don't know when you're going to be around somebody who might need that kind of help.
And like, not to sound like an old geezer, but it's a wicked world out there, man. And with the introduction of fentanyl and all of that stuff, you don't know who's using. You don't know which situation you're going to find yourself in.
Right.
And so, like, after talking with you, like, I'm going to go get me some Narcan and I'm going to keep it in my glove box, you know, just in case. I mean,
those resources are available to us. We should have them.
Yeah. And so, Seneca, I love you, man. And I'm sorry. I don't know what to say. I didn't know what to do. You made a difference. You lightened up every room that you ever walked into. I sat and read all the comments on your Facebook page, and everyone talked about what an amazing man you were, and what a dedicated father you were, and what an amazing person you were. You left a mark, and you made a difference. I think your time was cut a little bit too short. But wherever you are, I hope you're pain-free. And I hope you're looking down, knowing that we're going to do whatever we can for your beautiful, lovely daughter. Thanks for being you. And rest in peace, my friend.